Nadia Bolz Weber calls for a sexual reformation in her latest book, Shameless. How does her reformation compare with the truths rediscovered during the 16th century Reformation? I've written a review of Shameless in the latest Issues Etc. journal. We'll send it to you for free. Just click the red journal subscription button on the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Pastor Andrew Abraham details his journey from Catholic priest to Lutheran pastor. The free online Issues Etc. journal. It turns out that the theory of evolution has an accounting problem right down there at the ground level. It can't account for the changes that are observed at the molecular level, especially inside the cell, all those changes that they claim have taken place over millions of years at the genetic level, can't account for it. It also can't account for another big problem, and that is that those genes are information storage systems. And the question naturally arises, where did the information come from in the first place that our genome stores and puts into use in our bodies, in the bodies of all living things? Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Our series on creation and evolution, are they compatible, continues on this Wednesday afternoon. Dr. Doyle Holbird joins us. He's professor of biology at Bethany Lutheran College in Mankato, Minnesota. He delivered an essay at a recent Evangelical Lutheran Synod convention titled, My Help Comes from the Lord, Maker of Heaven and Earth. Dr. Holbird, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd. I'm glad to be here.
Do a little review of what we've discussed so far by way of kind of assembling the best evidence for evolution and responding to it.
Yes. Well, some of the things we talked about last time, I think we began by talking about some of the incompatibilities between what the scripture teaches and what evolution teaches, and how even the things like the order of creation differ between those two accounts. And then we began to talk about the evidence that exists for evolution, and there is some evidence for evolution. Scientists wouldn't believe it if there was no evidence at all. But then can that evidence be interpreted in a different light? And so we talked about evolutionary trees, nested hierarchies that are predicted by Darwin's theory, and how those trees that are supposed to show how things have evolved through time, really, those trees are sort of worked into the software that they use to make those trees now. And often those trees disagree with each other depending upon the mechanisms that you use and what you choose. Oh, things like proteins. So if you make a protein tree or a gene tree, evolutionary tree, you'll get differing trees depending upon which genes you use. And sometimes those trees are completely incompatible. Then we also talked about things like shared pseudogenes. We talked about the Gulo gene, which is the broken vitamin C gene that all the great apes and humans share, and yet those genes to be able to make your own vitamin C are intact in monkeys, and evolution teaches that makes great sense. If we are evolved from ape-like creatures along with the apes, then it makes perfect sense that we would share that broken gene with them that is actually intact down the evolutionary history back in time, and that it was broken sometime before the apes, and now we share it, and so do they. And so that is some of the evidence in favor of evolution, and we said, well, that broken Gulo gene is actually contradicted by the Y chromosome of chimpanzees and humans. There are so many differences that it looks like rather than 6 or 7 million years, which evolutionists predict, that it would represent at the rate of mutations as they occur in chimps and people, the number of differences that we see in the Y chromosome would take actually, I don't remember what we said, about 100 million years, I think. And so it seems as if all of the evidence that can be marshaled for evolution has other explanations besides the evolutionary explanation.
So now we're going to talk about the evidence against Darwinian evolution, but we need to do a little tutorial on basic molecular biology to kind of get our bearings. How would you go about that?
Yes. Well, we'd start out by, I guess we would define molecular biology as the study of life molecules. But really, in common usage, molecular biologists, I mean, they can study lipids, they can study sugars, but in common usage, really it means to study DNA or proteins or RNA. And really, the most common usage means to study DNA. And so let's talk about DNA for just a minute and remind people what a chromosome is. Chromosome is where the information is recorded and kept that codes for all of the proteins in our body. And the chromosomes are made out of two ingredients, and those ingredients are proteins and DNA. Now, the proteins are there to keep the DNA from being tangled up, because in every cell of your body, you have about 6 feet of DNA. Now, that's amazing that it can be packed into a microscopic area, but you have about 6 feet of DNA in there. And so the proteins keep the DNA from being tangled up, but it is the DNA that encodes the information then that allows our body to make every one of these some 100,000 proteins. Now, that information is recorded in what we call genes, and a gene is just a section of DNA that encodes either a protein or some kind of RNA intermediate or RNA helper molecule or RNA regulator molecule or something like that. So those are what we call genes. And the strand of DNA is actually made of two strands, and they go in opposite directions, and those two strands have a backbone on each side, and then they have rungs that connect them, those two strands do, so that it looks like a ladder. The backbone, we would say, goes across the outside and the rungs across the middle. And to make up those rungs, that's actually where the DNA code is encoded, is in those rungs. Each side contributes one base to each rung, what we call a nitrogenous base. And that base is a chemical, and there are four of them. So we have like a four-letter alphabet, except they're chemicals. And those four bases are, and people will probably remember this from their high school biology class, but those four bases are adenine, guanine, thymine, and cytosine. And those four bases, depending upon the order in which they occur along that strand, spell out a code for how to make an individual protein. It's very precise, and something else about that DNA code on each strand is that the two strands have to be complementary to each other, or they don't bind together and make one total strand. And so the bases, the individual bases, are where that binding takes place, and so that's where the complementarity occurs between those bases. And so you have, if you have an adenine on one strand, it will have a thymine on the other strand that joins it. If you have a cytosine on one strand, it will have a guanine on the other strand that binds to it. And that's very precise. Adenine must always combine with a thymine, and guanine must always combine with a cytosine, because they don't fit very well into the strands if they're not in that order. And your cell has mechanisms to make sure that those bases are put every time a cell replicates. It's got to replicate its DNA in it. And it can it has mechanisms to make sure that they're inserted correctly. So that's a little bit about molecular biology.
Let's talk about the evidence that is, and some of this we've actually touched upon a moment ago, but some of the evidence against evolution at that very level and at larger levels. You want to talk about incongruent evolutionary trees. What are these?
Yes, and I sort of mentioned this a minute ago, but it often occurs. Now, we don't use large characteristics of animals, what we call morphology. What is their shape? Do they have wings, or do they have arms, or do they have front legs? We don't use those kind of characteristics anymore to make evolutionary trees. We use gene sequences, and we use protein sequences. And oftentimes, so here's what an incongruency means. It means that when you take, say, 30 or 40 animals, and you take the same gene for those that exists in all 30 or 40 animals, because we share an awful lot of genes with all the other life on Earth. And so if you take the same genes and you make an evolutionary tree, when that tree is supposed to show how that gene has mutated through millions and millions and millions of years, and it is supposed to show the ancestral relationships between these animals based upon that one gene. And so if you take two different genes and you make an evolutionary tree for each one, we would expect that those two trees would agree, because those animals, if evolution is true, they had the same evolutionary history regardless of which protein we use to sequence that evolutionary history. And yet we oftentimes get different evolutionary histories dependent, in other words, one animal doesn't fit on the tree in the same, the branch for one animal is in a different place on the tree, in other words, is what we're saying, if we select different proteins. So there are these other molecules called microRNAs that we can also use. That information is also encoded in the DNA. And if we use those genes to make trees, they don't agree with the protein encoding gene trees. And so those are what we mean by incongruencies, and sometimes those incongruencies are quite marked between these animals, and that defies really a good explanation within evolutionary theory.
What are overlapping reading frames in DNA, and can Darwinian evolution explain them?
Well, let's first explain what an overlapping reading frame is. Whenever you have a gene, there is a region at the beginning of that gene that says start. Here's where this gene starts. And it's very important that it start at that exact location, because if it doesn't, then it starts with the wrong base, and it ends up, essentially, it will end up with gibberish when it tries to make the protein. Well, there's two kinds of overlapping reading frames. We already said that each strand of DNA is actually two strands. And so there are two kinds of overlapping reading frames. One kind of overlapping reading frame is where you have one gene that is embedded within another gene. And this is very difficult to account for, how you can get two genes, one overlapping another, or one embedded within another, through a process of very slow, gradual mutations that have accumulated over millions of years. Because once the first gene is in place, how can you change it to get the second gene? Essentially, what we're saying is they both have to be there at the very beginning. What this is like is if you have a book, say one of the novels by Mark Twain, say Huckleberry Finn or something. So he wrote a novel, and then, but if you start reading that novel at, say, the 50th word. So you count the words and start on the 50th word. And if you start reading there, you have another book entitled War and Peace. That's the way these overlapping reading frames are. Now, there's another kind of overlapping reading frame. That is, when one strand of the two strands is going one direction and it has a gene, contains a gene, and on the other strand going the opposite direction is another gene. This is like if you take a book and you read it. So you read one of Mark Twain's books. When you finish it, you take it to a mirror and hold it upside down and look in the mirror, and there's another story that if you read in the mirror, you can read a story in reverse that is a completely different story, like War and Peace again. Once again, once a gene has been encoded in the DNA, how can you begin to embed another gene using the very same letters? Remember, an A always has to pair with T, and a C always has to pair with G. So it's very difficult to account for this kind of information. And about, there are at least 700 and maybe more genes in the human body that we know of already that have overlapping reading frames. And it's an astounding thing to see this, these overlapping reading frames, because first off, they had to have been put in the genome intact just as they are for that to happen. There is no way on earth for slight mutations accumulating over millions upon millions of years can account for two genes that are embedded within each other like that. But it also testifies to the incredible intellect that created these genes, where you can have a gene that encodes a useful protein going in one direction, and on the opposite strand of the same overall strand of DNA, you have another gene encoding another protein. That's just an incredible testament to the kind of intellect that it would take to figure that out and put it in there, because they had to be in there at the very beginning.
Dr. Doyle Holbert is our guest professor of biology at Bethany Lutheran College in Mankato, Minnesota. We're talking about creation and evolution. Are they compatible? Part two of our three-part series with him. On the other side of the break, how does evolution attempt to explain the information in the genome? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for August is the new Growing in Faith Bible. It's written for children, grandchildren, and godchildren, ages 8 through 10. The Growing in Faith Bible contains more than 100 Bible stories with beautiful, engaging pictures. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040, or browse before you buy at issuesetc.org. The Growing in Faith Bible, the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for August.
LCMS Disaster Response provides guidance and assistance to congregations who seek to proclaim the gospel and show mercy in the wake of disasters. We can bring capacity to your congregation through on-site assessment, volunteer training and congregation preparedness, and through grants direct to your congregation. For more information, follow us on Facebook, keyword LCMS Disaster Response, or visit our website at lcms.org/disaster. That's lcms.org/disaster.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Lutheran Federal Credit Union offers mortgage and auto loans, checking and savings accounts, credit and debit cards. During August, if you open a Lutheran FCU loan to meet your financial needs, or if you use your Lutheran FCU credit card for a qualifying amount of purchases, Lutheran FCU will give you cash back and give that same amount of money to Lutheran Friends of the Deaf. Learn more at lutheranfcu.org. Good for you, good for the church. Lutheran Federal Credit Union, lutheranfcu.org.
The Substitute Organist Service, aptly abbreviated SOS, really has come to our rescue.
Pastor Jim Hollowatch of Christ Lutheran Church in Jackson, Mississippi.
With the ever-growing shortage of skilled musicians in our community, we were approaching a real crisis. But thanks to the Substitute Organist Service, help is always just minutes away. With its easy, intuitive interface, friendly customer service, and outstanding musicianship, you really couldn't ask for more.
You can find out more about the Substitute Organist Service at churchmusicsolutions.com. The Common Core of Concordia University, Wisconsin, with Preserve Thy Word, O Savior, playing right now at our 24/7 sacred music station, Lutheran Public Radio. You can listen to sacred music according to the church year anytime, any place at lutheranpublicradio.org or on the LPR mobile app. It's part two of our three-part series answering the question, are creation and evolution compatible? Dr. Doyle Holbert is our guest professor of biology at Bethany Lutheran College in Mankato, Minnesota. He delivered an essay at a recent Evangelical Lutheran Synod convention titled, My Help Comes from the Lord, Maker of Heaven and Earth. So far, we've been talking about the nitty-gritty of evolution, the nitty-gritty of the genome and of molecular biology. But what about the information that is stored in those molecules that make for life? Dr. Holbert, how does evolution even attempt to explain the massive amount of information that's stored in the genome?
Well, evolution does attempt, and evolution can, I'll have to say this, it can account for some of the information. So we do see things like mutations that are able to account for things like the different colors of certain flowers, and rose breeders even do those kinds of experiments on their own and come up with different colors and different consistencies of the flowers of roses. You can account for the different shapes of leaves on trees or the different sizes of trees or even animals, oftentimes with these kinds of mutations and then natural selection sometimes acting on those. But it is very difficult to account for this vast amount of information and the complexity of this information. And to get at this, I'd like to just read a paragraph, if you don't mind, that is written by Rob Carter, who is with Creation Ministries International, because it encompasses the way this information is encoded in the genome. And he says this: there are four dimensions, at least, that we know of in the way that the genome operates. First is the one-dimensional string of letters. That's those A's and T's and C's and G's I just mentioned. That's one dimension. And that is generally the way that evolutionists think about mutations and natural selection having created the information that is in the genome. That's the only kind of information in general that they can account for that way. And even that is very difficult. And some estimates are that about a third of biologists now have rejected Darwinism as a mechanism for creating this kind of information. I don't know if that's true, but it is a sizable number of scientists that are rejecting Darwinism now. And they say Darwinism can do small things. But to account for this vast amount of information and the complexity of it, we need a better theory of evolution. And there's a group called Evolution the Third Way who are trying to come up with other theories of evolution to be able to account for this. So I've just mentioned one dimension. Now there's a two-dimensional interaction of one part of the string with another part of the string, either directly or through RNA and protein intermediates. There's a third-dimensional spatial pattern of the DNA within the nucleus. And then fourthly, there are changes to all three of these dimensions we've mentioned over time. That's the fourth dimension. There's a time component to these things that can shut this information down or open it up so that it becomes active over time in the life of a human being. And so there's a tremendous amount of information packed into the genome we have not even figured out yet, with simultaneous overlapping codes, and we just mentioned some of those overlapping codes. These are things that evolution cannot account for. And so hence, the third way of evolution, the scientists who are looking for another way to account for it.
To put that in its most basic form, as we continue to study the genome, we realize it is on the levels of magnitude more complex than we first believed.
Oh, that is absolutely true, yes.
And therefore, the information contained therein and how that information functions within the gene is becoming more and more difficult for evolutionists to explain, to the point, as you just stated, that some are even saying we're abandoning Darwin at this level, at least on this issue. Is that what you've just said here?
Yes, that's absolutely true. Now, they wouldn't completely abandon Darwin. They would say once the information is there, it's preserved by natural selection. But yes, they're unable to account for these things by Darwinian mechanisms. Now, the old line evolutionists are sort of doing battle with them and saying, yes, we can account for it through small changes over millions and millions of years. But when you have maybe a third of biologists abandoning Darwin for the creation of this kind of information, that's a sizable defection from Darwin.
Talk about gene networks and how genes are regulated and why that also presents a problem for evolution.
Yes. Well, this complexity is not just in things like the overlapping codes in the DNA. There are these things called interlocking gene networks. And an interlocking gene network is a bunch of genes that operate in such a manner. And by the way, this gets to something that I just mentioned that Rob Carter mentioned, which is the time frame. These are a bunch of genes that operate in such a manner that whether they are switched on or off is dependent upon other genes in the network. In other words, the functions of these genes is interdependent one upon another, such that if one gene in this network is altered by a mutation so that it doesn't function or that it doesn't function correctly, grave consequences can result from this. And these can be exceedingly complex. For example, I mentioned one in the essay, which is called the DISC1 gene network. And it is a gene network consisting of 528 genes. Now, that's amazing. And these genes are active during the development of the nervous system in human embryos. So at that embryonic stage of a baby, these genes are switching on and they're switching off. But not just that, they switch each other on and switch each other off in such a way that one gene may turn on a dozen other genes and it may turn off seven others. 528 of these in this gene network. And let me mention this. Some of these genes are only turned on for a half an hour or an hour during the entire life of a person. They're turned off once they've been turned on, never to be turned on again in the life of an individual. And not all of them are like that, but many of them are like that. And these kinds of complex things. Now, an evolutionist might say, well, yes, but this is not that difficult to account for example, one, by adding a piece of this network at a time, because we do the same thing with the internet. We add nodes all the time to the internet. And that itself is true, but that's a simplistic explanation because all you're doing is adding a node. The node doesn't switch on and off other nodes. And that's the part about these interlocking gene networks that make them so complex, is that some of them will turn on others and turn off, and at the very same time be turning off. They may turn off a dozen and turn on a dozen at the same time. And it is very difficult to see how these could have built up one at a time, because once you have a few of them in place and you have an animal that can survive and actually has a nervous system, when you add the next node, the odds are that it's going to do damage rather than actually help. And so once these things are fine-tuned, you just can't add anymore. And that's the problem for evolution. And it is the interlocking gene networks and the overlapping genes. Those two bits of information, those are fairly recent. You know, in the last 15 years, we've been discovering these things. And that is when the scientists have actually begun to defect from Darwin. And it's because of that kind of information and the sheer complexity of it all.
And as you have said here, the problem with this notion of kind of neutral selection is that these mutations may not immediately kill the patient. They may fly under the radar, as you say, of natural selection.
Oh, yes. Well, that's exactly right. So I mentioned this gene network with 528 genes, right? If one of those genes is turned on at the wrong time or turned off at the wrong time, what happens is the individual can grow up, but more than likely that individual will have something like autism or bipolar syndrome or schizophrenia. And so that's the kinds of things that can happen if just one of those 528 genes goes haywire. Now, one of the things you're mentioning is neutral evolution. And neutral evolution says that, well, and the way modern evolutionary theory is comprised is this. It says, well, the way we gain new information is that a mutation occurs that is a gross chromosomal abnormality. So it's a big mutation that actually duplicates a bunch of genes, either a single gene or a bunch of genes, most often a bunch of genes all at one time. So now you have two copies of those genes. One of those genes is free to mutate into something else while the other gene stays and does its normal job. Now, there are problems with that idea, too. But what evolution says is that the one that's going to change and do something else first has to have a big mutation that shuts it down. Because if it stays on while it's mutating, it's likely to kill the organism, or at least deform it in some way. So the idea of neutral evolution has taken center stage. And neutral evolution says that you have a gene that maybe gets shut down, and then it's free to evolve, and it can evolve and become a completely different gene over a few million years, when finally it becomes activated again through a fortuitous mutation. Now it's active again, but it has mutated so much, it's a completely different gene by this time. The issue with this, first off, is, well, it's a good story, but the evidence is hard to come by for this. Now, there are duplications of genes. We see that sometimes. Well, even duplications of whole genomes sometimes, in the case of some plants and even trout and salmon have duplicated genomes. But the idea of neutral evolution, that you have mutations that are neutral until finally a gene is switched on, it's very difficult to find the evidence for that, frankly. So you have a lot of mathematicians that do this kind of work, but the actual biological evidence is really thin, and it has a lot of problems.
You say, to conclude this part of our conversation, that evolutionary theory is so malleable, it's really difficult, even knowing these cardinal weaknesses in the evidence, it's hard to make an argument against it because the theory is so fluid.
It really is, yes. And if you go online to forums where evolutionists and creationists are arguing, sometimes there will come a point where an argument has been made by a creationist that sort of shuts down the evolutionary arguments. But that doesn't seem to stop the argument. What happens is the subject just changes and people just keep arguing. But that's what happens. It seems to be able to take whatever data you find. There have been lots of ideas that should have shut this idea down years ago, like, for instance, the interlocking gene networks, or the information running both directions in a single length of DNA. And yet they take it in stride and say, well, if you have enough time, anything's possible.
Dr. Doyle Holbird is professor of biology at Bethany Lutheran College in Mankato, Minnesota. He delivered an essay at a recent Evangelical Lutheran Synod convention titled, "My Help is in the Name of the Lord, Maker of Heaven and Earth." Dr. Holbird, thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you, Todd.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll discuss the Churchwide Assembly of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America with Uwe Simonetto, and we'll get a review of the movie Once Upon a Time in Hollywood from Pastor Ted Geese. Well, I don't think time is going to be on evolution's side. They can keep begging for more of it to come up with explanations, but the fact remains evolution is unable to explain the facts, unable to do what it claims it does. I'm Todd Wilkin. I'll talk with you tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.